Luke has rightly been called a, however anachronistic it sounds, a proto-feminist. If you read the gospel, you'll notice that every time something happens to a man, Luke immediately follows over with something happening to a woman. So Gabriel comes to Zachary, Gabriel comes to Mary. A guy comes up to them in the temple, and then a lady comes up to the temple. And so it goes on and on and on and on. And he's doing this quite intentionally. A man loses a sheep, a woman loses a coin. So it's important that we become aware of Luke's theological agenda in writing this stuff. Certainly, the parable of the prodigal son, which somebody has rightly called the prodigal father, is one of the most splendid in the entire Bible. It's quite remarkable. It inspired painters and musicians and ballet directors and all kinds of people to see in this a truly stunning example of the mercy of God. And you'll notice that the father didn't wait till this younger kid was utterly reformed. No, the kid was calculating, well, I better get home because I can at least get my belly full with this. No, the father pursued him. The father came after him. And it's only when the kid became aware of his father's compassion, as the text has it, that he was able to say, in a quite different register, I suggest, these very same words, I've sinned against heaven and against you and no longer to be deserve to be called your father, your son. And you'll notice that the context for this whole story is a bunch of people who are complaining about Jesus fraternizing with the no-goods. All that is very important, and it warrants. I once taught an entire semester's course just on this parable. So rich is it, so multi-layered in meaning. But I'd like to talk primarily about something else. If you hear this thing from Exodus, then you hear this thing from the Gospel of Luke, you feel like you're living in two different worlds, and in fact you are. The world of the God of Exodus, as depicted here, is a world of a vengeful, vindictive, punitive, angry, irascible, oriental potentate. And that depiction is consonant with all kinds of depictions of God. God gets very easily ticked off. God immediately goes for a gun. But if you read the entire Hebrew Bible, something quite remarkable emerges. The text is self-correcting. This image of God in later writings is radically rejected and replaced with the God that we see reflected in this parable of Jesus, the merciful God, the God who's not irascible, the God who's not angry. The reason I bring this up is that this is something very important, especially for us Romans, Christians. And the nodal point, of course, is the meaning of tradition, what's been handed on. When I was in the seminary, we had everything in Latin, but the slogan was, tradition is whatever's been handed on, full stop, you know. Which means what? That we preclude the possibility of anything new happening. And this is, I'm afraid, characteristic of a Roman mentality, not just of the curia, some of the popes, but of us too. Nothing's new, nothing new. In fact, we had another Latin slogan in the seminary, don't do anything new, don't do anything new. There's a whole lot of historical reasons for that. Probably the major one being what Father Luther wanted to do in the 16th century, which is to say that the church had betrayed its own heritage in a number of particulars, which was true. And out of that grew this reform movement, which later became known as the Reformation. That's all these excommunications took place. So what's the point? We read the scriptures very often, and our fundamentalist sisters and brothers do this routinely in a totally ahistorical fashion. Nothing's new. When I was teaching scripture, I used to call it the salami school of scripture interpretation. You get a loaf of salami cut here, 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 here. And it'd be all the same, no matter where you dug into the bloody thing. The fact is, if you read the Hebrew Bible, as well as the New Testament, God is always the God of changes. If God has a verb in her name, it will be the future tense. I will do this. I will do this. In other words, what is going on now is inadequate, and something new is going to happen. And if you look at the history of the church, although we just assume ignore this, there have been, in fact, major doctrinal changes in the teaching of the church. This is extremely important, because for the spiritual life, which is a life, it's not a set of abstractions, principles that you live up to all the time. It is a life. It means it's changing. It's changing. And if you go to the history of the Second Vatican Council, which is extremely illuminating, the council was divided about 90% to 10%, and the 10% happened to be those in charge in Rome, in the Curia, who said, nothing is changing, nothing is changing. Alfredo Ottaviani, whom some of you may remember, the head of the Congregation for the Defense of the Faith, his motto was, semper idem, always the same, always the same. That's rubbish, folks. That's pure rubbish. That's pure rubbish. It's blindness. It's blindness to what has historically happened in the church. And we have in the figure of Francis I extraordinary things, where he relativized, for instance, celibacy, priestly celibacy. He said, this is not a dogma. This is not a doctrine. This grew out of some moment in church history. It doesn't have to be there. And I strongly suspect, if he's not killed before he ends his papacy, why a lot of people were quite distressed by him, that we'll see more radical changes. Why? Because God is always calling us forward. God is always calling us beyond where we are, who we are, what we are. And really, it's one of the great failures of the church to resist that, to deny it, even worse. There's a wonderful phrase from Hildegard of Bingen. She declared a doctor of the church. You may have heard of her, 12th century Benedictine abbess. She said, I want to be a feather on the breath of God, which is to me to be in a state of constant mobility, constant moving. And finally, the great Henry Newman, Cardinal Newman, 100 years ago, wrote this astonishing document called On the Development of Doctrine. Because he saw, because he was a scholar of the first 6 centuries of the church, of the fathers of the church, so-called, he saw all these changes. He knew what historically had happened. The development, even within those first 6 centuries in the church's life. And he came to summarize this thing in a wonderful phrase, to live is to change. And to become perfect is to change often. Clearly, words to live by.